From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Lauren Strawn, sitting in for John Wells, who is at the Future in Review Conference in San Diego this year.
Our next guest, Sophie Bushwick, gets to learn about many varied areas of science and technology exploration as a science writer and also the technology editor for Scientific American magazine. Now, this month's cover story is about pterosaurs, these flying monsters that were the first vertebrate animals to evolve powered flight nearly 80 million years before birds, if you can believe it. Then we're going to ask her to talk about that and switch gears to talk about quantum computing and maybe some other stories from the October issue of Scientific American, all in a day's work for Sophie Bushwick. Welcome, Sophie, to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Really nice to have you back. We decided that we spoke with you some months ago, and it was so much fun talking to you. And really, as I said, how quickly and easily you switch gears. All areas of science and technology. How do you do it?
I'm curious about a lot of weird things, but I mean, sometimes it's really easy. Like, it's very easy to be interested in pterosaurs because they are these giant, they look like giant deformed monster birds, but they're not birds at all. And they're this completely different, line of evolution, but they're fascinating.
So the pterosaur was varied in size as well. Some the size of a sparrow, others with a wingspan of a fighter jet. And they were basically like this huge jaw that would just fly along and I suppose swoop down and eat really huge things. We're really glad that they're not around anymore.
Yeah, they were terrifying. So you talked about that huge head. Their head, in some of the later species, the head and neck were about 75% of the body. Just these, like, yeah, a giant head on wings swooping down and, you know, eating whatever it wanted, basically.
So, hi, Sophie. This is Lauren here.
Hi, Lauren.
My question about these monsters is that it kind of makes me think about what environment they were living in. If they evolved to basically be giant flying jaws, then it implies that there was a lot of food, and all you really had to do was just swoop down and open your mouth, and you were set. Is that right?
Well, it really would depend on the different species. So, like you said, there was a lot of variety in what pterosaurs looked like, and they lived over a really huge span of time. Like, there was over 100 million years when these animals were flying the Earth. In comparison, humans have been around for about 200,000 years. So in that really long period of history when pterosaurs were flying, the Earth changed a lot over that period, you know. And obviously, different species of pterosaurs were adapted to feed on different things. So there's not any it's sort of tricky to say just what any one of them ate. A lot of what we know about them, scientists have found out from studying fossils, not just the fossils of their bodies, but also the tracks that they might have left as they were running over the ground before lifting off. And that's how researchers found out, for example, that so birds are bipedal. They take off of two legs and then they fly with their wings. They think pterosaurs were actually, when they were on the ground, they were quadrupedal. So they could use their front limbs that the wings were on to actually run along, and that helped them launch themselves into the air.
I saw that depiction in the article, and it was fascinating to see how the pterosaur would kind of start by squatting down and then lean forward a little and then literally just launch itself, a big four-legged jump.
Yes.
Before taking flight. So why do scientists think that the pterosaurs died out but not the bird-like dinosaurs 66 million years ago?
So 66 million years ago is this big extinction event when a lot of large dinosaurs and when they think all the pterosaurs died out. And essentially at that time, there were flying dinosaurs. They had evolved feathers and they think that the smaller flying dinosaurs survived, evolved, and turned into modern birds. But pterosaurs didn't. So one of the problems was that pterosaurs were so big. If you've got a body that big, you need to eat a lot of food, and a lot of that just wasn't as available during this period. And then another issue was that because they flew, they needed the air to be able to support them. And when you had the asteroid hit, a lot of debris gets thrown up into the air, the atmosphere changes, and they might not have been able to hold themselves aloft in the same way. So it was, some of these species, it looks like they could glide and stay airborne for incredibly long periods of time. They might have touched down, you know, only to mate. And so it's possible that they just weren't able to do that anymore when the atmospheric conditions changed.
That is so interesting. You mentioned in there about the bird-like dinosaurs evolving feathers, and I believe that pterosaurs had membrane-like wings instead of feathers. Can you describe the differences there?
Well, if you picture a bat wing, it's got membrane stretched over the bones, and that's what gives it its lift. So that's kind of what you can imagine a pterosaur wing looking like. It probably had other things on it. It's really hard to say what the skin of these of dinosaurs or of pterosaurs looked like because they've been dead for so long that a lot of that evidence is lost. But they think that it was the lift it came from a membrane-based wing, more akin to a bat wing than to a bird wing. And they think that actually that type of wing had a greater lift, which allowed such big animals as pterosaurs to actually be airborne, because birds just don't get that big because they wouldn't have the strength to fly and to support all that weight. But the membrane-based wing, along with a couple other adaptations that pterosaurs had, allowed them to reach these huge sizes and still fly.
It's making me think of the crazy humans that jump off the Swiss Alps in their fly suits.
Yes, yeah. Yes, you can kind of picture that, but you have to imagine those humans having much longer arms. You know, so they'd have a bigger wingspan. They'd also probably have longer necks and bigger heads. So the kind of cool thing about these big-headed pterosaurs is they didn't have giant brains to fit in them. So a lot of their head of the skull space might have actually been hollow, which would have made it a lot lighter and easier to support than if it was an equivalent. If a human head grew to the same size, because the brain case in the human skull is so big, we'd have much heavier heads to support.
Imagine the preponderance toward concussion in that case. Holy cow.
Yeah, that would be a huge problem.
Or there's a lot more padding around a very small brain.
Yeah, could be. Well, let's segue into the next topic of quantum computing. I was going to try to segue by mentioning that what we know about pterosaurs now is due to not only the study of fossils, but mathematical modeling. And so this is another area that you write about and that you are the editor of at Scientific American. Let's go into quantum computing. And we hear that word quantum. And I wonder if a lot of people think that it's a word much like meta that we use. We say, a quantum leap. And it means just something really large, but we don't think it actually means anything. So let's talk about first the difference between a classical computer and a quantum computer.
Sure thing. So quantum mechanics sort of describes the way that things behave on the really, really tiny level. So quantum mechanics might describe the behavior of individual atoms. And it turns out things that small don't behave the way something scaled up would. So classical mechanics is you send a ball rolling down a ramp. Quantum mechanics is you're looking at these atoms, and they don't behave in the same, you can't predict their behavior with the same methods that you would use to predict, say, the speed of that ball going down the ramp. And the cool thing is you can actually harness those effects. and some of those effects are really weird. And by using them, you can compute in different ways. So a regular computer is based on bits. So these little pieces that can be a 1 or a 0, sort of like a switch being switched on or switched off. And you can store information in these bits because of them being either 1 or 0. A quantum computer uses units called qubits, and those they can be more than just 1 or 0. They can be some probability in between 1 or 0, which gives them greater flexibility, and it means that they can calculate information in different ways. And so the cool thing about quantum computers is it's thought that they could solve certain kinds of problems exponentially faster than classical computers. So there's some types of problems that your regular computer just can't solve, even if you've got a supercomputer working on it. Some of those types of problems are a snap for quantum computers, and they can do it with much less power than a regular computer would require.
And so we know that companies like Google and Microsoft are heavy into figuring out quantum computing, and there is an alarming prediction, and that is that once we figure out quantum computing, that we're worried that quantum computers will enable the destruction of encryption that we're so worried about, that keeps our personal data currently protected. And this is what the article is about in this month's Scientific American.
Right. So this is an article we published on the website, scientificamerican.com, and it is looking at what's going to happen with encryption. So encryption is the way you sort of encode your data, your personal information, the way you might use a cipher code to send a secret message. And the way a lot of the modern encryption methods are based on a type of mathematical problem that it's really easy to solve in one direction but hard to solve in another direction. So the example that's used is if I told you to multiply two numbers together, you could probably do it fairly easily. But if I gave you a big number and said, what are the prime factors of this number, that would be a problem that's harder to solve and it would take you longer. And that's certainly true for humans when our brains are doing it. Classical computers are much better at solving this type of problem, but even they have trouble when you make these numbers have, you know, hundreds of digits. And the thing is that quantum computers could solve that type of problem extremely easily. You know, it wouldn't even be a barrier for a working quantum computer with enough qubits. And researchers are well aware that this is a problem, so they're looking for a new type of mathematical problem that they could base new encryption systems on. And so what they want is a type of problem that's just as hard for a quantum computer to solve as it would be for a classical computer to solve.
So what does that quantum computer look like? I'm envisioning today's classical supercomputer. It takes up a huge room. It needs a lot of air conditioning units to keep it cool and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it actually requires a large amount of energy. Is that similar for quantum computers?
Yes. One of the things about quantum computers is in order for them to function, they rely on these qubits being entangled. They need to be related to each other. And it's very easy for qubits to lose that connection between them. And so in order to prevent that from happening, you have to keep a quantum computer extremely cold. It needs to be at very, very low temperatures. So often if you see a photo of a quantum computer, what you're really seeing is a big chamber designed to keep it isolated and to keep it cold. And then inside that chamber is a little tiny chip that represents the actual computing power of the machine. And that is definitely, so you can imagine that if we scaled up quantum computers and got them big enough, it would require a lot of energy to keep that type of machine cool. But the technology is continuing to improve. You mentioned a few different tech companies are working on it, but there's actually a lot of great human brains working on solving this problem of getting a working quantum computer. And the thing is, we just don't know when that will happen. So estimates range from, you know, maybe it'll happen in 10 years or in 30 years. But the idea is that at that point, when it's working, that's when encryption is going to be in big trouble. And that's one of the problems that people are working on right now. So NIST, for example, is currently having essentially a contest, having different organizations submit their ideas for encryption. And then that way NIST can set a standard method of encryption that could be used as the backbone of a new system.
Wow, it kind of blows my mind to even think about this stuff. So let's take a break and go to an easier topic, perhaps. Which, but that's fascinating. And that was an article that you researched about and you wrote about quantum computing. Again, it's on the website. It's on in the online version.
That's right.
So obesity on the brain. What mm-hmm. we know is that we're supposed to eat food that you find in the perimeter of the grocery store. In other words, whole foods. And that's pretty easy. But we follow all these trends that say, you know, 25 years ago it was eat all carbohydrates and low fat. And now today it's like, don't eat carbohydrates and eat lots of fat because it's healthy. And I think our rational selves say, you know, somewhere in between seems to be maybe the way to go. But what we do know is that processed food and ultra-processed food cannot be good for us. And that's what this article proves. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so one thing I was interested to learn from this article was the difference between processed foods and ultra-processed foods. You know, I think we do, there's definitely a tendency to think, oh, something comes in a can, it's processed. But there is actually a difference. So basically, ultra-processed foods, you could kind of summarize it as something that's designed to be ready to eat right out of the container, or at least ready to eat after you microwave it. So this category might include a lean cuisine prepared meal, but it could also, as well as a candy bar or even a flavored yogurt would fall into this category. Plain processed foods are foods that do have things added to them, but they're mostly, the things that are added are to maintain the preservation or the taste of that one thing. So this category could include salted nuts, and it could include, you know, canned tomatoes, but it wouldn't be, this apparently is not as bad as ultra-processed foods. So you could think of maybe a processed food would be a can of tomatoes with maybe some salt added and some something to preserve it. But an ultra-processed food would be that can of tomatoes turned into ready-to-eat tomato sauce, where they've added a lot of additives that maybe you can't pronounce the names of, including oils and fats, maybe some color enhancers to make it look really red.
Mm. So
and it could be...
So it'd
sorry,
be a little bit...
I'm sorry. Please go on.
So it'd be a little bit like the difference between buying a salad dressing, a prepared salad dressing, and then versus just making your own with a little bit of
that's right.
olive oil and vinegar.
Mm-hmm. You could think of it like that. Yeah, absolutely.
What are some of the concerns with food insecurity and ultra-processed foods, right? You need, if you live in a food desert, you need foods to be preserved. And I think back mm-hmm. about my grandparents and canning, and they had pantries of peaches that were years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that would fall maybe into the category of processed foods. So if you buy a can of, say, chickpeas, you're probably not going to just take a fork and eat them out of the can. You might rinse them off and add them to a recipe that has other parts. And I agree that I think being able to can things and add preservatives definitely allows people to eat a much more balanced diet. The problem is when you have a food that that has a lot of artificial and real sugar, then, for example, and fats from different sources, because what researchers think is happening is that when you eat something, your brain and your stomach are actually communicating about what they expect to get out of it. So if I'm eating a piece of cheese on a cracker, my brain is sending signals about, okay, it looks like this will give you a certain amount of energy, and so you need to put your power towards processing these particular ingredients. And I think the problem with processed foods is it might send a mixed signal. So if I'm drinking a diet soda, my brain might be saying, okay, this is a delicious sweet treat, and so it's going to have a certain amount of calories, and you need to be able to process those calories. Go to it. And then when your stomach's trying to process it, there's not actually any calories in there because it's a diet soda. It's got artificial sweetener. And basically, it confuses the signaling that tells you when you're going to be full. So what they did is they've done a sort of proof of concept study where they put people in very controlled conditions in a hospital, and they got to eat foods with the same amount of calories, the same balance of carbohydrates and fats, but some of the participants were given those in the form of ultra-processed foods, and other ones were given them in the form of less processed foods. So, for example, you might have a breakfast of turkey bacon and egg substitute in the ultra-processed food group, and in the less processed foods group, you would have maybe eggs fried in butter. And what they found was people who were eating those ultra-processed foods had to consume more calories in order to feel full. It was as if even though they were eating things with the same caloric load, the calories weren't telling their brains that they were full at the same point.
This is a really scary finding that, and what it does is it triggers the chain reaction of those people, as Lauren says, that might be in food deserts that are eating more processed food that already have issues with obesity. It will just keep them going down the line of being more and more obese versus those who have access to whole food and unprocessed food. That's kind of scary.
It is, because the issue isn't only about access, it's also about time, right? So ultra-processed foods are convenient because you can just eat them, whereas processed foods or unprocessed foods, you have to do a little bit of preparation before you put them in meal form. And so if you have the leisure to make a nutritious meal for your family, you're going to be able to provide healthier food. Whereas if you're working multiple jobs and you just don't have the time to make a meal yourself, you're going to be kind of stuck eating these ultra processed foods, which have, you know, a list of additives whose names you can't pronounce, and that send these conflicting signals to your stomach about when to stop eating, and it's very difficult to avoid that in certain situations.
Sophie, we could go on talking to you all day, but we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
But My pleasure.
Before you go away, can we please say that tortilla chips are not ultra-processed? I love tortilla chips.
I mean, I think that if you are having tortilla chips as maybe a little snack, again, I think this isn't anything in moderation. I don't think the studies are suggesting that you should completely stop eating processed foods. I think that it's okay to have a treat once in a while, yeah. But I do think that you could very easily keep eating tortilla chips forever and not feel full. At least I can.
Yeah, I know.
And I think that kind of gets to the root of the issue with ultra-processed food.
No kidding. So true. Sophie Bushwick is the technology editor for Scientific American magazine.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.